From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Avian influenza, bird flu, is on a roll right now on poultry farms in the U.S. Since the beginning of this year, it's shown up in Arkansas, Idaho, Kansas, Missouri, North Dakota, South Dakota, Oregon. It's big right now in Iowa, where millions of chickens are being destroyed to try to stop it. In Minnesota, where mountains of turkeys are being put down. In Wisconsin, where they've activated the National Guard to join the fight to save an important food source to keep the virus from mutating, jumping to humans. This hour on Point, the American battle with bird flu. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Have you heard about the devastation on farms right now? Poultry farmers, what are you up against? How far could this go? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll look at the recall of Bluebell ice cream because of listeria contamination. Lots of states involved in that. But joining me first today from Des Moines, Iowa, is Amy Mayer, who covers agriculture for Iowa Public Radio in collaboration with Harvest Public Media. Welcome, Amy. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. So we first read 500,000 birds would be put down. Now, today I'm reading 3 million some. What's the number? Where are they?
Well, the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship did update the number yesterday. I think 3.6 million is what they were then putting out after an earlier estimate that it was going to be upwards of 5 million.
And describe the farm where this is happening, Amy.
We know that the farm is in Osceola County, Iowa, which is in the northwest corner of the state. It's a commercial laying hen operation. Iowa is the nation's largest egg-producing state. So these would have been hens whose eggs were put into the commercial shell egg marketplace. The farm has not been identified specifically. USDA doesn't give out premises identification generally in these types of outbreaks, but we can understand from the size that it is a large, one of the bigger players in the egg production system.
I mean, at 5 million or 3 now, Iowa does something like, what, 5 or 50-some million birds there? If they're putting down 5, that'd be almost 10%. It sounds like a big number. This is USA Today is here saying Sonstegard Foods Company out of the Dakotas, I think, affiliated with this farm. What do we know about how many barns, how the birds were, what birds will be destroyed? There's not going to be 5 million because they weren't at full capacity when the virus got in here, Amy?
Well, the reason the virus was even identified was that the people who managed the barns were noticing higher fatalities among the birds than they would normally expect. And when that happens, it triggers sampling and testing. And first, it was the South Dakota State University Veterinary Lab that made a positive identification for avian influenza. That was then confirmed by a USDA national lab here in Ames. And once that happens, that triggers the process of what they do to quarantine or contain it, and then, as you mentioned, euthanize the birds and eventually disinfect, monitor wild and domesticated birds in the region. And then ultimately, once they have done the disinfecting and the monitoring, they will test again before repopulating those barns to make sure that the virus is gone.
That is a big hit for any farm, and this is a big operation. That's a lot going down. I guess they're having to kill all the birds on the premises, right?
That's right. I mean, one of the things about this strain of influenza is that it is highly pathogenic. That means it's incredibly contagious, and it will just wipe out a flock. And so once they see the significant mortality that triggered the testing, and they know that what they've got is this really contagious disease, then they do euthanize the entire flock.
Now, this is H5N2 avian influenza. It's one particular strand. It doesn't go into humans at this point. Of course, there's concern about it mutating over time. What about chickens, and what about eggs? In terms of food supply for humans, is there an issue there at this point, Amy?
At this point, there isn't. In fact, Iowa state agencies were issuing reminders late yesterday, that this strain of avian influenza does not contaminate the food supply and it is not infectious to humans. And so they really wanted to reassure consumers. And partly that's because in the international market, many countries that would normally import eggs and poultry products from the United States have restricted those imports because of the influenza outbreak. And so that's going to mean more is available for domestic sales. And so I think there's a bit of a desire to make sure that American consumers are aware that this strain isn't going to impact the safety of their food.
So they don't want it abroad, but it's fine for us at home. And we're glad if that's true. The farm that's been hit here, the eggs were put into a kind of liquefied for baking, right? Not going out as individual eggs. But I was reading here that maybe going out in tanker trucks, just a whole lot of egg in there.
That's a lot of egg, yeah, for sure.
We're in the middle of a big outbreak, not just in Iowa. This is not usual, Amy.
It's not. It is unusual. In fact, I began reporting on this outbreak, or the origins of this outbreak, in January, when a strain of avian influenza that had been in Asia was identified here in the Pacific Northwest. It was at the time only in small backyard flocks. Even as I did my reporting, right after my story aired, a commercial flock in California was tested positive. And then it's just been in these few months that we've seen more positive identifications in the West, and then obviously in the recent weeks here in the Midwest as well. So there's also significant concern further east, because there's a lot of poultry produced in Mid-Atlantic and North Carolina, South Carolina states over there. So it's definitely on the minds of everybody who's involved in poultry production.
Lots of turkeys being put down as well have been in Iowa, also in Minnesota. Scott Walker, governor in Wisconsin, has activated the National Guard to help them get this under control. And the idea is that this has come in probably with wild birds flying down over the middle of the country, down the Mississippi Flyway, as they call it, droppings coming down and people tracking those into American farms?
Right. I mean, they think they have tested some wild birds, not a lot, but they've tested some and seen that the wild birds can carry it but not be symptomatic. So it doesn't kill the wild birds, and that's why they're able to travel these long distances. And yes, they drop it. It can be, I think in some cases it can be spread airborne from droppings. When I was on a turkey farm in January, the farmer was very concerned because although his turkeys are all indoors in the spring and summer months, he likes to open the sides of the barn so air can flow through. But with the potential for this kind of infection, that really made him nervous. And it makes him really worried when he sees the migrating birds fly overhead.
The new byword is biosecurity. It sounds fancy, but it can just boil down to not tracking, you know, their droppings into a farm. But that's all not easy to actually execute. Here's Sheila Larson, Iowa farmer, raises 200,000 turkeys every year, saying she's trying to protect her poultry by not tracking in the infection.
We want to make sure that our feet are clean, our hands are clean, our clothes are clean, but knowledge gives you power. And if you know how to handle it and you know the best way to prevent it, then that's what you do.
And where does this end? Where does this go? We're going to look a lot at that in this hour. But as long as the wild waterfowl are flying overhead, and of course they do, no quick solution to this. Here's late last week, poultry expert Ron Keen talking with Wisconsin Public Radio, saying the chance of this going away anytime soon, slim.
I think the concern is that since it's in wild waterfowl, it may just be a couple of years of those birds migrating back and forth from north to south and back again. I think the hope is that, you know, in a couple of years, either the virus will mutate, which it does readily, or maybe birds will become a bit more immune to it. Not a rosy outlook.
Maybe mutate in a way that makes it less contagious, but it could mutate in lots of directions. The concern always about it mutating toward being infectious for humans. Amy Mayer, we've got a caller from your neck of the woods, Suzanne in Grinnell, Iowa. You're on with Amy Mayer of Iowa Public Radio. Thanks for calling, Suzanne.
Oh, hi, Tom. I guess I would like to have sorted through who is going to take the financial hit from this. Are these contract growers? And is there maybe a thought for setting aside some sort of disaster relief, because this is their entire income? So I just didn't know what the legal and economic structure of these bird houses is.
Yeah, it's a great question. Amy, what can you tell us?
I can't answer the question completely, but what I can say is that there are some federal compensations when a flock needs to be destroyed for a situation that is, you know, I guess you could say, for the greater good. The caller was asking, are these contract growers? She's talking about who owns the birds. Does the company that ultimately markets them own the birds, or does the individual farmer on whose lands the barn sits own the birds? There's lots of different relationships that producers have with their ultimate customers or their corporate customers. So those details I don't know about, and I'm sure they are working that out, the companies with their contractors and the government, but there are some funds set aside for this kind of compensation when a flock needs to be destroyed.
My understanding from reading for the show is that if they're killed by the disease, it's just a loss. If they're put down to avoid its spread, there's some per chicken or per turkey payment from the federal government, so there's an incentive to get ahead of this thing, though not easy to do. And we're hearing from Hormel Foods, very large food company, puts out a lot of turkeys, that the number of turkeys put down already and infected, they're saying, has created significant challenges in our turkey supply chain. I don't know what that means for turkey sandwiches or Thanksgiving, Amy. Is this likely to show up as a factor in the market for poultry?
It certainly could. I'm glad you mentioned turkey sandwiches, because the turkey farmer who I visited with in January pointed out that it used to be 35 years ago when he started in the business, you were primarily raising turkeys seasonally for Thanksgiving and Christmas. But now it is a year-round industry. Most of it is going into deli meats and other turkey products rather than whole bird sales. So it is year-round, and that means that you can't take a hit in 1 month and not have it reverberate. Also, when I was on that farm, I thought I'd mention, Tom, that regarding biosecurity, I had to put on a hairnet and a white lab coat. Mm-hmm. I had to put on booties over my shoes, and then even with the booties, step through a disinfecting pool before I could walk into the barn. And I'm sure now that these commercial flocks are infected, they wouldn't even let somebody like me do that. I'm sure I wouldn't be allowed in a barn today.
But it's serious business, difficult business. They have to get trucks in and out of there, and a whole lot of what is eventually freight here. Minnesota, just since it was first confirmed in March, 2 million turkeys put down there. We're talking very big numbers. Amy Mayer, you're great to get us started here today from Iowa Public Radio. Thank you so much for joining us from Des Moines.
You're welcome. Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, the sound of an industrial chicken farm there. Chickens in their millions being put down, destroyed, killed right now to stop an outbreak of avian influenza, avian flu, bird flu. Biggest one right now in Iowa, but it has hit many American states just this year. Lots have been put down in Minnesota as well. Scott Walker has called out the National Guard in Wisconsin to help deal with this, and there are concerns about it spreading more widely. And, of course, ultimately, the question is, could it mutate further? Could it get into humans? We saw that in Asia in the last decade. Here's Ron Cardell, an Iowa turkey farmer, talking with Iowa news station KWQC, saying that they're really careful about who comes on to the farm now, thinking about what could get tracked in terms of disease.
Well, obviously, there's tremendous concern, and because, you know, the raising of the poultry is part of our livelihood, anything to put a block and a barrier between the outside world and these turkeys that are inside a building. Any place where the general public has potential foot traffic, which could be a hunter, it could be a fisherman. I mean, people aren't doing this intentionally.
They are not doing this intentionally. Some, of course, have to go in and out. It's their work. But this is very contagious stuff. Here's Mark Cook, professor of animal sciences at University of Wisconsin-Madison, saying it's difficult to prevent avian flu from reaching barns, especially when it's prevalent in the environment.
Everything I ever wear gets washed every day to this day for fear that I might move something from one place to another.
Joining us now from Auburn, Alabama, is Joseph Giambroni, professor of poultry science at Auburn University. Professor Giambroni, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. It's a pleasure.
And with us from Philadelphia, Cheryl Davison, professor of avian medicine and pathology at the University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinary Medicine. She directs the Laboratory of Avian Medicine and Pathology. She's also a poultry veterinarian. Cheryl, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Cheryl, can you put this in some kind of context for us, the scale of this outbreak? How often have we seen outbreaks like this?
Well, I'd like to go back in history a little bit to 1983 and 84 here in Pennsylvania, where we had a very large outbreak of avian influenza. It was an H5N2, a highly pathogenic virus, and it killed 17 million birds with a cost of $60 million. It was regional. It affected some flocks in Pennsylvania, also in the Virginia area. This outbreak that's going on now is more extensive because it is involving many states across the nation. And also, there's more evidence that this is in wild birds now as one of the sources.
Joseph Giambroni, talk to us about how this is coming onto North America and into the United States.
Well, the interface between wild birds, backyard birds, and the poultry industry itself is not well known, but the mantra or conjecture is that these free-flying wild birds, mainly waterfowl, can spread the virus up to 10,000 miles while they migrate. And from China, where this virus has been probably for 10 years, those Asian birds have gotten and bred with birds from the Canada, and that they brought it down into the U.S. Somehow, these birds spread the virus to backyard birds, which are outside of the poultry industry, outside of the chicken houses and turkey houses, and then was brought in probably from humans, tracked it into these barns, and then spread from farm to farm through humans. So I think presently the virus has not infected humans, and over 10 years the possibility is rare, but the virus is genetically unstable. There is always the possibility that an H5N2 from wild birds could recombinate to an H5N1, which has infected humans, and there could be an outbreak. But that is low, but we need continual surveillance to protect that from happening, which is going to need to be done by federal, state governments, the poultry industry, universities, and this has to continue worldwide, because I don't think the virus will go away anytime soon, because it appears to be endemic in wildfowl, and you certainly can't depopulate wildfowl or control them. So it is a challenge to the entire poultry industry, and there always is a fear from other countries and even farmers with consumers that it could get into poultry, but into humans. But right now, that is not where we're worried about. We're worried about it spreading to other poultry farms and companies throughout the U.S. To answer one of the questions that was posed by you before, the federal government indemnifies or pays only for the birds depopulated. The bulk of the loss comes to the poultry company because they own the birds, but the farmer himself loses in the profitability. These farmers are mortgaged. They have to pay their mortgages.
Sure.
They can get behind, and ultimately it will affect the consumer and the people that market it. There's a multiplier effect from about 4 to 1, which means that losses then to the industry itself will amplify to 4% or 4 times the losses, which are to the marketers and to the consumers. And if it spreads, it could cause companies or farmers to go bankrupt.
Well, we can clearly see the potential for huge financial losses here. The health issues loom larger still. Talking about wild ducks and geese and coots and cranes carrying this. Joseph Giambroni, Cheryl Davison, lots of questions for you from our callers. Casey in Charleston, South Carolina. Casey, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. My question is concerning the environmental conditions of these birds. You said that wild birds aren't symptomatic. So will this virus be less likely to affect organic farming or pasture-raised poultry because they live in better environmental conditions?
Interesting. Let me hold that question, Casey. I appreciate your call. I'll get one more about the wild birds and organic. Barb in Lincoln, Nebraska. Barb, you're on the air.
Yes, I have the same line of questioning there. Maybe the way we're raising birds is wrong, keep having them cooped up in these horrible conditions and mass producing. I am a member of Sustainable Agriculture in Nebraska. We have one chicken on our small farm, which we have more at times, but we have, I just think it's not a problem, but what's wrong is the way we're raising our chickens.
Barbara, let us pick that up as well. I think we've got it. Cheryl, okay, this farm in Iowa had typically would have 5 million plus birds on it. And here are our callers. First question, why are wild birds not symptomatic when they have it? And domesticated poultry is, and what about the manner of farming? Does that make a difference in terms of susceptibility death rates?
First off, with the wild birds, we know historically that the birds can carry it and aren't symptomatic, and that's been historic, and we know different avian influenza viruses over the years, and we've had several different outbreaks in the United States where there is different susceptibilities depending on whether it's a chicken or whether it's a turkey, et cetera.
But is that because of the genetics of the wild birds or the environment that they live in? Do we know? Do we understand?
Well, I think part of it is the genetics and not really the environment that they live in. Mm-hmm. And that moves us forward to the question about whether organic farming or birds that are kept outside are more or less susceptible. And what we see in this outbreak and what we know from other situations that birds that are raised outside are as susceptible as birds that are raised inside. So it's not really the management of the farm or how many birds that are on the farm. And it's evidenced by the backyard flocks that are, in fact, infected right now with this particular virus. It is important to know that in many states, with the organic standards, and that's a USDA national standards, that the birds are grown, have to have access to outside. But the organic auditors right now are allowing the birds to stay inside to reduce the risk that they are going to be infected. So they are just as susceptible as those birds that are raised inside. And it is important, whether you have one bird, whether you have a larger number of birds, the same biosecurity principles still hold. You need to make sure that they don't have contact with wild birds. You need to make sure that you are clean when you go work with your birds, make sure other people aren't coming onto your premise. So you need to do all the same biosecurity principles as a large farm would do, but they are just as susceptible as any other bird, whether they're grown inside, outside, whether a large farm or a small farm.
I mean, we're reading here that these big farms may be sealing their birds off even more because of the threat of this in the environment, getting into their flocks. Of course, if it's a small operation, you got 15 chickens, 15 die. You've got 5 million, it may be 5 million that are die or are put to death. I want to go right to someone who's in the middle of this kind of big poultry production right now from Morristown, Minnesota. Kim Halverson joins us. She owns Halverson Farms. Produces 3.5 million pounds of turkey every year, about 100,000 birds spread over through two barns. And this has not been an easy time for her, as with others. Kim Halverson, thank you very much for being with us for a couple of minutes today.
Hi, Tom. It's nice to be with you today.
We're reading about you, Kim, in USA Today. You had a nightmare the other night. What was it?
The nightmare was that I had opened the door to my barn and the birds were all dead. And it was so real that when I woke up in a sweat, I got dressed and went to the barn to check. And it wasn't. Everything was fine.
Thank heavens.
But we are in nightmare conditions. Someone equated it to a tornado. When you hear a tornado siren, you get prepared, and you physically and emotionally get prepared for this, and you're prepared for an hour or two or maybe even three. But in this case, as growers, we need to be prepared for 6 to 9 weeks of this.
Kim, you're saying nightmare conditions, not because it's hit your farm. I guess it hasn't, but the fear that it could at any moment is what puts you in that state, I guess, Kim.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We don't know. We know that it's traveling through the flyway, through the Mississippi flyway, and we know that it's carried by the wild waterfowls, the ducks and the geese.
Yeah.
We know that they defecate outside.
Sure.
We don't have control of that,
mm-hmm.
And we have we've always had biosecurity methods in place, but we're more aware of making sure that every I is dotted and T is crossed regarding biosecure methods.
Kim, what's the scenario here? If you have one or two birds die, do you immediately suspect that it's this? Do you get it confirmed by a vet before you start putting other birds down, or you get a few that die and you put them all down immediately? What's the contingency plan?
No.
Okay, help us
the
here.
The protocols that are in place are that every barn has its own mortality card. It's a card that we keep track of how many birds were placed into the barn, and each day if you've had mortality, you write it on that card.
Yep.
If you see a large bump in mortality, In yesterday's world, we may have tried to identify what was going on and medicate for that. In today's world, we will immediately call in. I'm in Minnesota, so I would immediately call in the Minnesota team to test for AI. And
AI, avian influenza, yeah.
Avian influenza, the H5N2.
Mm-hmm.
And I would immediately call and look for those testings to happen immediately.
I mean, you talk about the emotional toll of this as well. People sometimes think that if you're, you know, do this on a very large scale, as you do, that there's no more emotional connection here. But you waking up in such a night sweat, there clearly is, Kim.
Oh, absolutely. And part of that has to do with this is our livelihood.
Mm-hmm.
So this is how we make a living. This is how we feed our family. We have four children.
Yeah.
And, you know, as I heard you speak just a little bit earlier, you know, when that goes away, that's a problem. That would be a problem for any person out there if their livelihood would go away.
Absolutely. And many, many, of course, across the country. Kim, please stand by there in Minnesota. Michael's calling from Swampscott, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank
Hi.
You.
Yeah.
Just a quick comment question to your panel. The food value of all these chickens and turkeys, is there any discussion about getting them to market or into the hands of people who are desperately, you know, desperately need food? Can they be processed?
Yeah.
One of your panelists said that the avian flu doesn't affect the food chain, the human food chain, so I was wondering if that's a possibility.
It's a good question. Kim, I'll come first to you on the turkey. If it does get into a turkey operation in a serious way, is there any way that food value of all those turkeys can be saved, or do they have to be? I'm reading here about them being composted.
No, they're depopulated and composted, and that's why our food market is so safe in the United States. Before any of my birds go to market, I am blood testing them a week and a half to 2 weeks prior to them entering the plant to be processed. I am fat testing a week prior to them going into the plant and be fat tested. Both of these samples will not only go into a Minnesota lab, but they'll also go into a USDA lab. I believe my samples are sent to Virginia.
Yeah.
And so that is all tested before the truck ever rolls onto the site and removes the bird from the site. And then not only that, once they're processed, as they're going through the processing piece, as they're hung on the shackles and going through, there is a USDA person grading those birds as they go through. And just a point, I am only paid for live, wholesome pounds. And what that means is if a bird is degraded or not allowed, I'm not paid for that bird. So it's incomprehensible that I want to do a bad job at what
sure.
I'm doing. I need to bring the best possible product to the market, and as I've always said, we not only feed our neighbors, but we feed the world.
Joseph Giambroni, if it's so safe, why not sell the turkey instead of destroying it, if there's no danger in the meat?
The problem there is that if people have this perception that it is in poultry, that they're not going to buy it. So, but in fact, right now, all of our poultry is processed, and during the heating to defeather the bird, the virus is very heat labile, which means it'll kill the virus. And also, the majority of our poultry is not sold as whole poultry anymore, which means it's further processed even further. So therefore, the virus is going to be killed in the initial processing and in the further processing.
But as it stands now, it's being composted a long way from the market. Sorry, Joe, we have to take a short break here. Kim Halverson at Halverson Farms. Are your turkeys for sandwich meat or for Thanksgiving turkeys, Kim?
No, we are the sandwich meat variety, as well as it may be Thanksgiving in that we do whole breast meat. And, you know, if there's just one or two people for Thanksgiving, you may just go into the store and buy a 3.5-4-pound piece of breast meat.
Kim, we wish you such good luck here. We hope it doesn't hit your farm at all. We'll be watching, and we thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are talking this hour about the big outbreak of bird flu among birds, poultry. In the USA, millions of chickens, turkeys put down, killed just in the last few months to try to stay ahead of it and keep it from mutating to humans. We'll look at that as well. Cheryl Davison is with us from the University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinary Medicine. We've got Professor Joseph Giambroni with us from Auburn University in Auburn, Alabama. Here's Dennis Dravetsky, president of River of Dreams Farms in Wisconsin, talking with Fox 11 News, saying farmers need to work alongside animal health experts to ensure food safety.
The average farmer is a hardworking man and woman. They know what they're doing, but they're not experts on animal health. Veterinarians. Inspectors, those are people we are counting on.
Lots of response online here, and a lot of it, Cheryl, Joseph, goes to the scale of farming, and that question's still here. Dustin says, if birds were raised sustainably, without hormones or other engineering, would they still be so susceptible? Karen, maybe this way of farming is dangerous. Maybe we need humane small farms again, or better yet, go vegan, she says. Poor chickens. Kimberly says, calling these places farms just endorses the myth. These are factories. Cheryl, is the scale a significant issue? We asked before, but listeners are still really pushing on this front. Is the scale and manner of farming the issue?
And again, the answer is no, it's not. But I do want to have your listeners know about the misconception that we use hormones in poultry. No poultry farms, no poultry producer will use hormones. And that's a misperception that is out there. And that needs to be clear that no poultry uses hormones. I work with many backyard producers. And the advice that I'm giving to them is to reduce your contact with wild birds. So if they have a wild bird feeder in their yard near their poultry, I have them put that in a different area. If they're going into their coop, they have dedicated footwear to go in there. Again, they are just as susceptible. And to think about who is coming on to see their birds. It is very, very important that they use the same principles that a larger producer would use, because these birds are just as susceptible. As you can see from the outbreaks that we've had, there are backyard birds that have become infected. So I really encourage my clients to use the same exact principles. And we are going to have a webinar with Backyard Poultry Magazine next on the 30th at 10 a.m. to really get information out to the backyard poultry producer, to the smaller producers, about biosecurity and to make sure that their birds are safe.
Because this could come east as well, and of course backyard flocks are everywhere. We've got a question on that front. Forgive me, Cheryl. Lisa in Portland, Connecticut. Lisa, you're on the air.
Yeah, hey, this is just the perfect time to step in on this question. I have a small flock, 15 birds. And I'm wondering, is this something that you can watch progress in your birds? What are the symptoms, or do you just go out and suddenly they're dead?
Joseph?
I'll take my answer offline.
Yep, thank you, Lisa. Joseph, what do you say?
Let me go back to what one of the original callers was saying, that we need to go back to small flocks, which are outside the houses. Those, in fact, are the interface. They become infected first, and then they're brought in to the large poultry producer. The reason we produce 100,000, 500,000, and a million birds on farms is that we're feeding the rest of the world. We are the largest poultry producer in the world, and 25% are, in fact, exported. So if we stop producing the chickens in the amount that we're producing them, about 10 billion meat-type birds, we have about 350 million layers, probably several billion with turkeys. You know, we just can't go back, because then we end up with an undersupply of wholesome meat to the rest of the world. Now, this, you know, it gets back to surveillance. We have to have continuous surveillance, continued biosecurity. I see some sort of change which is going to have to take place in the poultry industry, where if you get onto a farm, first off, it's going to have fences with lock gates. Anyone coming in is going to have to go to a separate building, take their clothes off, take showers, put clothes on which are designed only from the farm, and then they're going to have to shower in and shower out, because the houses themselves are enclosed, and there's not enough virus floating in the air to be blown in and to infect a poultry farm and produce the disease. So we have to cut down on movement of people, and not only people, but equipment that can carry the virus in.
Boy.
But that's a
so that's the direction
problem.
We're headed, into sort of more closed and more isolated, a long way from your bucolic kind of image here. Asif in Austin, Texas, thank you for calling. Asif, you're on.
Hi, Tom. My quick question is, I know we are killing a lot of chicken and turkey in this regard because of this spread of the virus. Is there any vaccination or any other treatment available which can be given to the chickens who are not affected or already been exposed and can save this, you know, waste of
a lot
of poultry?
It's a great question. Cheryl Davison, vaccination, scientifically, economically, would that be viable?
First off, there is no treatment for the virus, and that's very different from vaccination, which would be a preventative measure. And historically in the United States, we had not used vaccination for control. It was quarantine, eradication, monitoring, and what we've talked about with disinfection and testing again. What is happening right now is the USDA and industry is looking into a limited use in areas that are highly affected, a limited use of vaccines. The vaccines take several months to manufacture. It has to match what is the virus that is circulating at that point. And so that is something that is being discussed to use as another tool to control this particular outbreak, is to use vaccination, but it would be under strict regulation. It would be under the auspices of the USDA, and it would be only used in a limited area. And with the use of vaccine, it could, in addition to the export market that's been affected already, it could also add to more restrictions on the export market.
And, of course, we have such huge numbers here, billions of broiler chickens, something like 9 billion chickens a year in this country. I don't know if you can economically vaccinate. Not much profit on a single broiler. Rachel, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Rachel, you're on the air.
Hi. What I found really disturbing listening to this conversation is all the turkeys and chickens being referred to as products instead of live sentient beings that live a lifetime of suffering before they're slaughtered. And a solution to this problem would be for everyone to switch to an ethical vegan diet. Thank you.
Duly noted, Rachel. And I mean, I take your point entirely. And from the producers, I guess they do see it as product. And that's where we've heard that. Joseph Giambroni, I want to ask about the chance of this going to humans, mutating and going to humans. We were looking back just a few years here when we had the earlier bird flu outbreak, and Robert Webster at St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee, was talking about that being a real possibility, saying that he personally believed it would happen, that it could come up with a very virulent strain of flu that would hit many humans, maybe kill a lot of humans. What are the chances of that happening here?
Well, there's always a possibility because the virus is genetically unstable, but it's been in 10 years in Asia, and that has not happened. The sentinel humans, which are involved in the initial processing of the birds, would be exposed to the internal organs, and that's where we've seen the disease first occur in Asia. So if those individuals then are not getting sick, and in some cases they're actually monitoring people who work in a processing plant, then there's no chance they could get to consumers. And as I said before, the birds are processed twice, one on the initial heating to defeather them, and then on the further processing, all which could kill the virus. Now, getting back to vegans, I think that this is a wonderful country in which we can decide whether we want to go to a vegetarian diet or organic poultry, and we have the funds to do that. But in other countries, I have to go back to other countries, they don't have this. They want a cheap source of animal protein, and so therefore we provide that to them. So no one should be around to say that we have to do it this way or have to do it that way. We have, in fact, a democracy, and people then have a choice to determine what is the most healthiest and best for each person.
Cheryl Davison, briefly, your estimation of the risk to the human population if this should mutate.
Right now, we don't know that answer to that the question of whether it will mutate. And right now, the CDC looks at that very carefully, as along with the USDA, to monitor that virus and to make sure that people are safe. And right now, there is no risk to humans.
Watch this space, and I hope we've been able to be informative on this front today. Cheryl Davison, you've been great to be with us from the University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinary Medicine. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Joseph Giambroni, Professor of Poultry Science at Auburn University. Joe, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome.
In a moment, a listeria outbreak leads to a massive recall of Bluebell ice cream. This is On Point. On Monday, the 108-year-old ice cream company Bluebell, the country's third largest maker of ice cream, expanded previous recalls to now include all of its products because of listeria contamination. So far, the ice cream has been linked to three deaths. Karen Robinson-Jacobs is covering the story for the Dallas Morning News and joins us now. Karen, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
We'll look at what's going on. But first, some people live in the heart of Bluebell country and others don't. Remind us just what a big brand this is in much of the South, in Texas in particular.
Well, if you look at the sales numbers, it is one of the top three ice cream makers in the country. But if you look at the footprint, it's really only in about 30% of the supermarkets in the nation. It serves about 23 states, and they are mostly in the South and in the Southwest. But it just shows you how much people in that area really have grown up with this ice cream and really love it. It has almost a cult following. So it's able to rack up pretty significant sales, even though it's not sold across the country.
Why has Bluebell recalled everything? It's not just ice cream that they're taking off the store shelves, but everything. Why?
This is an expansion of a problem that surfaced back in early March. And initially, their first sense was that it was very limited, very small, and mostly affected only product that they sold to, like, hospitals. That's where the first patients surfaced were, in hospitals. In the time since then, they have found listeria in at least four of their lines, in at least two of their plants. They have four plants altogether. They say that they did this out of an abundance of caution, particularly with their Broken Arrow, Oklahoma facility. They still have not been able to determine where the listeria is coming from. And so they wanted to bring everything back and basically strip everything down top to bottom, clean everything, make sure they've got it all out, and make sure that any trace of listeria is out of the marketplace.
So the danger is that the listeria, which can be deadly, lives in the nooks and crannies of the manufacturing equipment?
That's the thing about listeria. Listeria loves cold, moist environments, and so it's perfect for ice cream makers of deli meat. You often see listeria outbreaks in, you know, sliced deli meat. And in some cases, Tom, companies have had to throw out very expensive pieces of equipment because they just can't find it. It sort of embeds itself in places that are hard to get to, hard to clean, and companies literally have had to throw out equipment because they just can't get it out. They just can't find it.
Bluebell found this in chocolate chip cookie dough ice cream, half gallons of that. And one of the crazy things about it is, of course, as you say, it likes cold. If you put it in the freezer for a long time, it doesn't die. It stays active.
It exactly right. And that is part of the reason that, you know, we are seeing some cases of people who ate the ice cream, years ago, because ice cream does stay in your freezer for a very long time, and B, one of the things about Listeria is that if you are a healthy person, you might not see symptoms for, up to 70 days. So if you're having symptoms today, you're not necessarily going to be thinking about, what did I eat 70 days ago? So it's been a very hard bacteria for them to eradicate, and it's also been a very challenging puzzle piece for health officials to kind of put together. What they have to do is figure out who got sick, what did they eat, and then they have to try to match it up to the strains of Listeria that they have found in the Bluebell product.
70 days before it might hit you, but also you could have it in your freezer, ice cream or frozen yogurt, sherbet, exactly. Frozen snacks, they've got all that. Right. And if you bought it and you pull it out later, it's still dangerous.
That is absolutely right, and that is why both the CDC and the company have urged everyone to take any product back to the store, get your money back, get a store credit, and it's all going to be destroyed. It's going to be shipped back to Bluebell, and it's all going to be destroyed.
Three deaths so far, but I guess that means if it's still out there in the market and people aren't aware of this, we could see more people hit with a Listeria.
We are likely going to see more cases as health officials put the puzzle pieces together as they look in the database to see who got Listeria. We have some cases that go back to 2010. So we most likely, it's pretty certain that we're going to see more cases. I don't know if we'll see more people getting sick now. The company has really tried to get the word out.
Well, Bluebell trying to do the right thing here, bring all the products back, closing down the plants to clean and clean and clean, but it is not easy. Karen Robinson, Karen, thank you very much for being with us. Karen Robinson Jacobs with the Dallas Morning News. Thank you, Karen.
Thank you so much.
Listeners, thanks for joining us today. You can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for all your questions and comments here today. It's always so great to have you right here with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Talk to you tomorrow. This is On Point.